It's Madison time. Hit it. You're looking good. A big, strong mind. When I say hit it, I want you to go two up and two back. With a big, strong turn and back to the Madison. Hit the top. You're looking good.
I woke up on Becky's bed. She was on the couch, leafing through a hardbound book. It was black, with a bunch of roses collaged on it. In the center of the book was the word, journal. Oh, shit.
Remember when I used to play with your sword during rehearsals?
She asked. I did.
I had such a crush on you, and I knew you felt the same way if that tramp hadn't shown up at the shat.
She smiled. Jennifer was not a tramp. She'd never taken me out to eat with her friends and had a 3-hour conversation about sex and swinging. She'd never gotten me drunk and taken advantage of me. She wasn't a tramp.
Do you still write?
She asked. I did. I hadn't written much poetry since high school, but I'd been working on a play and a few short stories.
Me too. It's funny. I started writing this years ago, and I just finished it last night.
And without asking if I wanted to hear it, she began reading from her journal. Terrible poems comparing our relationship to Romeo and Juliet's. I tried not to laugh at the audacity to elevate our romantic disconnection to the world's most famous double suicide. Then came the mixed metaphors involving a white picket fence and living underwater in Poseidon's kingdom. I wanted a cyanide pill, a razor blade in hot water. I wanted to go double Van Gogh, anything to not have to hear these terrible cliches about our supposed relationship.
So, what do you think?
I put my hands in my pocket to make sure the business card was still there. Aren't you dating Harry?
We have an open relationship.
Don't take this the wrong way. And I tried to find something I could say that could possibly be taken any way but wrong. Nothing came. Becky excused herself to the bathroom. She was in there for a long time. I heard tearing sounds, smelled smoke, and every few minutes I heard the toilet flush. She was burning the poetry book. I took my copy of the apartment key and my notebook and went out to explore more of State Street. I was in one of the music stores flipping through their used CD section when I found the U2 fans' Holy Grail, a complete collection of CDs known as the Propaganda Remixes, 5 bootlegs of all the non-album tracks from the Octum Baby Zooropa era. Each one cost $20. There was no way I could drop $100, even if it meant very happy new music to drown out Becky's voice. Look, the guy behind the counter said, Ron's too sick to come in, and that fucking Sarah girl you hired last week didn't even show up today. Even with 2 people, it's gonna take all night to do inventory. There's no way I'm doing it by myself. I know you've got a date, but fuck you, Jason,
He looked up at me.
He fucking hung up on me. Do you believe that?
I do. I co-manage a music store in Massachusetts. We go through 3 Sarahs a month, and I'm always the one stuck doing inventory.
Massachusetts? What the fuck are you doing in Madison?
Freezing. Being trapped into a possible relationship with a delusional ex-girlfriend. I'm on vacation.
Lucky bastard.
Maybe, I said. And maybe you are, too. If I help you do inventory, can you cut me a deal on some CDs? His eyes bulged.
You help me inventory this store, and I'll cut you any deal you want.
We agreed that I'd stop by at 9:30, a half hour before the store closed, and I'd stay until the job was finished, In exchange, he'd give me the whole propaganda collection for free and tell the owner they'd been shoplifted. It was only 6 o'clock. I decided to kill some time at the noodle factory. I was staring at the huge menu above the register when I heard a familiar voice behind me. So many choices, huh? It was Unharry. Welcome to the world of the bisexual. What? You know, like, the whole world is open to you, you just gotta make a choice. And like most people only want either noodles or sauce, but bisexuals are willing to get either or both, so there's more choices. Right. I ordered my rotini with Parmesan cheese, then I watched the cook sprinkle strands of cheese over my noodles. It was the most elegant macaroni and cheese I'd ever seen. Becky told me she read you her poetry. I nodded. Terrible, isn't it? Actually, I said, it's quite delicious. I meant her poetry. So she sent you after me, I asked. He snorted. Hell no. He was driving me back here, so I went out for a walk, and I saw you come in here, so figured I'd see how you were doing. Thanks. I'm fine. And I returned my attention to the rotini. He had a plate of spaghetti with marinara. The world's most boring bisexual. We ate in mostly silence, but every once in a while I'd look up and he'd be staring at me, elbow on the table, his head leaning on his fist. What are you doing? I asked. I'm trying not to stare like an idiot, he said. I find that if you rest your head on your chin, it looks more like you're staring like a genius. What? I saw the way you were looking at me yesterday. I choked on my rotini. It got me so hot that I ended up leaving the party with one of Becky's mom's friends. I just had that craving for cock. You know? Fuck. I did know.
Some days the line I walk turns out to be straight. Other days the line tends to deviate. I got no criteria for sex or race. Just wanna hear your voice, just wanna see your face. And she looks me up and down like she thinks that I'm mature, like she's gotten my number, like it belongs to her. And she says, call me Mr. Franco if there's anything I can do. I say, you know I got spots, did you know I have stripes?
I firmly believe that men are much better at cock-sucking than women. I also believe that women are better muff divers. It has to do with having the equipment and knowing how it works. I fully acknowledge that men can become great at cunnilingus, and women can become amazing at fellatio, but I believe this comes with practice, or inherent talent. The people born with this talent are roughly equivalent to the people born with perfect pitch. They're out there, but the chances of meeting them up over Craigslist or Love.com are pretty slim. Unharry gave much better head than Becky. We were in the back of his Corolla. I tried not to imagine which of Becky's mom's friends he'd done this with the night before. When we were both finished, he said, please don't tell Becky about this. He'll die. I had no plans to tell anyone. I made my way over to the music store a little early, where I inventoried my sins. We were done a little before midnight. Becky was asleep when I got back, and Harry was not in the apartment. I took my cell phone and the business card out of my pocket. Could have been a trap. Simone, Rachel, and Susan could have been really good friends with Becky if I called them. They promised to pick me up the next morning. When they came by, the three of them would hold me down while Becky duct taped my limbs together and locked me in the Tupperware bin beneath her bed, only taking me out for the occasional feed and fuck. Maybe it wasn't a trap. They seemed sincere enough and horrified enough by everyone else at that awful birthday party. I called. Had enough? Rachel asked. More than, I replied, and I detailed as much of the badness as I dared. I told them about Becky burning the bad poetry and the naked unharried, but I left out the sex. Jesus, she said. Here's what you need to do.
Tell it softly to me, baby. you never meant no one, no. Swiftly fading like your charm, but you're stepping out of line. You're spilling all the wine, leaving all the vine, 'cause I can't give you mine. I like the way you look, I know you like me, but one, baby, makes me.
Becky and I left her house at 11 in the morning. It was her day off. I told her how sorry I was for making light of her feelings, but, I explained, things between Jennifer and me weren't really over. And until we were completely finished, I didn't feel comfortable being with anyone else. I felt awful about leading her on, but I was glad she had on Harry. Anyway, I didn't want to infringe on her hospitality anymore, so I moved my flight up. My supposed flight left at 2:30 in the afternoon. I was so sorry, but this was really the best way, you know? According to the plan, Becky would drop me off around 1. I would wander around the airport until 2, when Rachel and Simone would pick me up. Susan was working. We didn't factor in Becky being the chaos machine. At 1:15, instead of looking through the airport gift shop or watching Becky's taillights disappearing, I saw a huge sign that said, "Welcome to Illinois."
Oh shit, Becky said. Oh shit, I missed the exit. I'm so sorry.
And she got off at the next exit, sped from exit ramp to entrance ramp, and the Jeep hit 110, flying back towards Milwaukee.
If we missed your flight, I'll pay the fees to get you on the next one. God, please don't think I did this on purpose. I'm so sorry.
I believed her. We got to the airport at 1:54. Still time to catch the flight I wasn't taking. Thanks, Becky. I'm sorry.
No, I'm not.
Sorry things didn't work out the way we'd...
And by we, I mean you.
...hoped. But thanks for the memorable trip.
I'm not leaving you yet. I'll walk you to the gate.
Oh, fuck.
But you're parked in a no parking zone.
No biggie. I left it running. Anyway, I gotta pee. I'll be right back.
Well, shit, fuck, bitch, ass, cooter, cunt, cock, dickweed. What was I gonna do now? I was standing in the check-in lane for a flight I didn't have a ticket for, and I had no idea where Simone and Rachel were. That's when I noticed the newspaper moving towards me at an alarmingly quick pace. There was clearly a body behind it, too. Firm, female-looking legs, and just as the newspaper passed by me, Rachel stuck her head around it and said, "Run!" So I did. Running is not a sport. It's a survival technique. A zebra munches on grass. She senses danger and her ears go flat. Whether the lion is sighted or not, the exodus begins. Zebras charging through the grassland, stomping through the plains. No rest until the danger is gone. All this and no Nike endorsement deals. With the help of 3 women who didn't like her very much, I managed to outrun Becky Krakow. I camped out on their couch for the remaining 9 days in Wisconsin. We made dinners together, crashed sorority parties, closed down hurricane bars, and made dozens of mixtapes that featured little digs at Becky that no one but the 4 of us would ever understand. I was almost having the time of my life, but this fun wasn't something I'd planned, wasn't the spontaneous product of a carefree life. This fun was the byproduct of running away from my problems. And even though I was fairly sure they wouldn't be catching up to me anytime soon, I was still uneasy about their proximity to my back. Every Jeep that passed was Becky. Every man I made eye contact with was un-Harry. Every joke I cracked made 3 people laugh and 2 people cringe. This is the way it's always been.
Jeremy Burdick hits me in the face with a rock. I run home. The Saint tells me that hanging out with Kevin Harris makes me look gay. I run away from Kevin without looking back. The first time I got tired of dating Becky Krakow, I gave her a Valentine's Day present and ran to the safety of my dorm, everything running. It's a wonder my feet ever touched the ground. This stupid fear of getting caught being who I was. Staring too long at St. Christopher's ass, or unhairy, or that stupid crying faggy baby Jeremy Bird Dick. I spent so much time running from who I was afraid to be that I never took a break to realize who I was. And now, here I was, running from Becky Krakow, a girl who'd never really done anything wrong except love me. And shit, even my running wasn't very original. Simone, Rachel, and Susan had already rescued one high school ex that Becky had trapped. Alan, Unharry's junior year roommate, a tall, goofy-looking kid with a blonde fro. He was obviously freaked out the very first night he was in town, Rachel said. Harry picked him up at the airport, and he met Becky and us at the safe house. So those fuckers knew where it was before I showed up? I wondered why they'd pretended they'd never been there before. And then one of Becky's stanky-ass friends showed up and kept flirting with Alan all through dinner. He looked so uncomfortable. I wondered if the skanky-ass friend was Michelle, if she'd laid her foot in Alan's lap while she bragged about how she orgasmed while giving head, if Becky took him home afterwards and read some poetry she'd written about him. He was weird anyway, Simone said. He was always looking at people like they were some sort of exotic meat. Rachel nodded. Gave me the fucking creeps. If they only knew. I hadn't spent much time in high school getting to know Alan. Pretty much all the information I had about him came through Becky. According to her, Alan's father was one of those rich shitheads whose jobs required him to move all over the world. That Alan never really settled anywhere until Torpor Heights, 5 years old and friendless in Madrid, caught torturing a parrot to death in Belize at age 7. At 12, he half-blinded a girl with a rock in Ghana. When he was 14, he did something in a former Soviet republic that made him chuckle, but that he wouldn't explain. Something bad enough to make his father send him to boarding school in America. At 15, he was assigned to live with Harold Brissett. I don't know how or when they started fucking, whether it was rape or if they were just two curious, horny teenagers doing what curious, horny teenagers do.
He totally cries during sex,
Becky said. We were backstage, rehearsing for Romeo and Juliet. I had a few minutes before I had to go out, so Becky was sitting in my lap, complaining about her sex life with Unharry.
It's so annoying. It's like he's terrified of the vagina. Like it's gonna eat him or something. Roar!
She wrapped her legs around my arm.
I don't get what's so scary about genitalia anyway.
Pussy looks like an unhealed scar, I said, or some chasm to an alien universe.
Oh, please. If there's anything alien-looking about genitalia, it's the cock. It's freaking hilarious. Big, droopy trunk and this hairy, floppy purse behind it.
Hey. Don't knock my sword, I said, grabbing my junk as punctuation. She chortled.
Please, I'm not afraid of your sperm purse.
You haven't seen Kilo yet.
Kilo?
She asked, short for kilometer. It was her turn to grab my junk. To her credit, she refrained from replying with the appropriate,
more like centi,
or cock forbid,
Millie,
joke.
There isn't a penis in the world that scares me.
And there isn't a vagina in the world that scares me, I replied, which was true. I wasn't scared of them, I just wasn't attracted to them.
Well, then you're one up on my gay ex-boyfriend.
So you guys are definitely broken up, I asked.
Do you think I'd be playing with your sword if we weren't?
To my credit, I refrained from replying with the appropriate truth.
You have to promise not to tell anyone, but, okay, Harry is totally gay.
I blushed. So you said.
No, I mean like he and his roommate? Fuck.
and I'm sure she kept talking. But I didn't hear a word she said. I was picturing Alan and Un-Harry trying to figure out who was top, whether they held each other afterwards. When I came to, she was looking at me. I was definitely supposed to be saying something. Why are you telling me this? The question became, why did she tell me this repeatedly? Every time we got together, there was some mention of Un-Harry and Alan having sex. Now that I'm comfortably in my 20s, I understand. She needed to talk to someone about how this guy she loved, who claimed to love her, was gay. How frustrated she was, and since Un-Harry and I weren't friends, and maybe in her eyes were romantic rivals, I was a perfect candidate. She didn't know that I, too, was a stupid, confused 17-year-old closet case, and because of how quickly and frequently she'd divulged Un-Harry's secret, I was now terrified to tell Becky Krakow anything that she could use as a weapon to her next boyfriend. So, a couple of weeks later, I gave her the stuffed bear and stopped talking to her. A year later, I was in the theater hanging out with J-Bob and a few of the techies when I heard Becky screaming. She and Alan were in the basement, supposedly working on one of the one-act plays for an upcoming festival. It wasn't a long series of screams and crying. It was a short burst of, "No, no, get off me!" followed by silence. None of us flew down the stairs to rescue her. I cracked jokes about how that must have been the first time she'd said those words. J-Bob and a couple of the techies laughed. A couple of them cringed. Becky didn't tell me how Alan had raped her in the basement that she had to spend 3 mornings a week rehearsing in until the summer I financed Jennifer's abortion. I was all out of comforting words. I mean, what could I have possibly said to take her pain away? Should I have told her about Jennifer? Should I have mentioned that I was starting to get the sneaking suspicion that my interest in gay porn wasn't so much a phase as an obsession? Not knowing the most soothing thing to say, I asked, "Did you tell Harry?" She didn't. She didn't tell Harry. She didn't tell her psychologist. She didn't tell a dean, so no disciplinary action against Alan was taken. And 2 weeks before he was scheduled to graduate, he raped a sophomore who did report it. But since, as far as the school knew, it was a first offense, they chose to let him graduate. After that, he disappeared for 2 years until either Becky or Harry invited him to Wisconsin. I don't know what happened there either. Why he had a black eye and a limp when he showed up at Simone, Rachel, and Susan's. How, despite all that, he still smiled through most of the visits.
It's not what you thought when you first began.
You've been listening to the In Safe Mode podcast, All My Exes Live in Sex Flicks, Slow Flashes, Part 9, Survival Techniques, brought to you by unreliable narrators and the infamous and torturous Jack McCarthy story term. Intro music for this episode was It's Madison Time, Part 1 by the Ray Bryant Combo. Incidental music included the Paul Oakenfold remix of Lemon by U2, In the Wake of Poseidon by King Crimson,
Fly Away by Lenny Kravitz,
In or Out by Ani DeFranco, and Your Little Secret by Melissa Etheridge. The outro music playing now is Wise Up by Amy Mann. This is probably about as lesbian a soundtrack as you are going to find on the In Safe Mode journals. For more information on this podcast and other things I've written, check out www.crookedtreehouse.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email me at insafemode@gmail.com. For complaints about the quality of this podcast, please email customerservice@comcast.com. Two-time winner of the worst customer service in America, striving for a third consecutive year.